The Guardian.
Hello, thanks very much. Welcome to the Guardian Book Club. My name's John Mullen, and I'm talking to Sarah Waters, you know that, about The Little Stranger, you know that. This is an historic moment for the Guardian Book Club because I think we've done 63 of these events, and we've had a different author each time. But now, not a sign of desperation, but au contraire, a kind of heartfelt, critical vindication of Sarah's oeuvre. Sarah came and talked to us about Fingersmith in 2006, and she's now here again to talk to us about The Little Stranger, and I hope that she takes it as a sign, which it is, that that we especially love her at the Guardian Book Club, that she's our first repeat offender. I'm sure everybody here has swatted up on it, and because of that, I'm going to... That's a terrible phrase, one of those phrases I find myself using and saying I'll never use again, and then I do. I'm going to cut to the chase. Who first said that? I'm going to cut to the chase and going to talk about the thing which we're specially allowed to talk about in the Guardian Book Club, and I'm going to do it first, which is the ending of a novel. Because I can't think of a novel that when you mention it, and especially, you know, if you mention in that sort of vaunting way I sometimes do, oh, I'm going to be talking to her about it, and that people will always say, they'll say, now, I want you to ask her and find out, and don't take this shilly-shallying either. And usually, because we can talk about it, because, of course, you know, in reviews of The Little Stranger, the reviewer's not allowed to mention the ending, just like they're not allowed to mention how any novel with a good plot ends. But, and I suppose presumably when you first published a novel and you were going to literary festivals and things, people couldn't talk about the ending, but we can now. And people always ask me, well, they ask usually quite a specific question, which is almost asked in the novel itself, which is you. You've got to ask her, who's you? Now, you see, I've read this novel three or four times, actually, and I'm pretty sure I know. You can shilly-shally. Is that a fair question to ask?
Yeah, absolutely, and it is actually really nice to be talking about the book in a space where I can talk about the end, because, you know, I've been talking about this book a lot since it came out 18 months ago. And even though, obviously, always, usually in your audience, there are some people who've read it, you can't assume that people have read it, especially when it's newly out. So I've had to do a certain amount of, oh, I can't say too much, and shushing people in the audience, you know, when they... So it's very nice to be able to talk about the end. And I had not anticipated when I wrote the book, well, when I started the book anyway, that the end would even be an issue. I thought the end was as clear as day. In fact, I still do, actually. And I often meet readers who have the same experience. I got a letter from a reader recently saying that he'd been online and he'd been in chat rooms and he'd noticed that there was a lot of debate about the book and some people feeling like they just didn't know. There wasn't a resolution. And he was like, it seems very clear to me, you know, does this drive you mad? And it hasn't driven me mad at all. It's been really interesting. But it has meant I've slightly had to find a way to talk about the novel, you know. I definitely aimed to make the novel relatively open-ended. My plan was always to make it as open-ended as I felt I could get away with without actively disappointing or frustrating readers. And unfortunately, I think I have disappointed and frustrated some readers. I know I have. This pops especially because, you know, for some readers, I'm known for, say, a novel like Fingersmith or Affinity, which has twists, but very clear resolutions. I mean, really clear Victorian meeting out of rewards and punishments and things like that, very tidy novels. And actually, the more I've written, the more interested I've become in untidiness. And so certainly with this novel, because it has, for me, it has a definite supernatural element, although actually I've met readers who feel it doesn't have a supernatural element at all. It's completely rational. Like Dr. Faraday, they think it's about mass hysteria or madness. But for me, you know, I planned there to be a supernatural element to this. And I do feel that by definition, you can't contain the supernatural. It is something inherently strange. So to that extent, I'm happy to let the novel be a bit open-ended. But to come back to your question about the you, I found when I began to give drafts of the novel to people to read, it was an issue. Would say people at my publishers, a few people read it, and they were like, kind of at the end of it. I mean, not like, I mean, you know, they were sort of, they were kind of puzzled by the ending. And I actually then had to do quite a lot of work to bring out clues that I felt were there already, to bring them out even more. And one of those was in that scene with Caroline near the end, where she says you, which of course is ambiguous. I might, you know, I wanted it to be ambiguous, well, otherwise I might as well have had her say someone's name. See, I'm still finding it really hard to be explicit about it, aren't I? But as far as I'm concerned, you know, it was the doctor. This novel came alive for me when Dr. Faraday began to become a more complicated character. And I hadn't planned for him to be anything other than a very reliable, straightforward, rational narrator right at the start. And he began to be a bit more complex, and his class history became more complicated. And then suddenly I began to see that he could become, perhaps even only gently, an unreliable narrator. So for me, you know, there are things going on in the novel that he definitely glimpses. There's a moment at the inquest into Caroline's death when he has a vision of her on the landing just before she's pushed or jumps or is frightened into falling, you know, over the banister. And he's looking into her eye and he sees a reflection in her eye, which for me was a very, very, you know, sort of big clue.
Was that sort of put in later?
That was put in quite later. That was,
I
think that was one of those things that got put in later. Although, I liked it. I didn't end up putting anything in that I didn't like.
Because there's two moments, haven't they, for me. There's one where he goes to sleep in the car after he's been out to help those people. It's an acute appendix,
yes.
I think. And he says, and I seemed, and he describes as if it were the beginning of a dream. I seemed to see myself go up the path, and then I became confused, and it was not the right place, or something like that.
Uh-huh.
So there's that, and then there's the one that you describe.
And then there's the last line of the book, when again he seems to glimpse something, the thing, you know, the little stranger. He's alone in the house at the end of the book, having possessed it, but having possessed this thing that's crumbling away. It's a very sort of empty gain. I always thought it was a very point, you know, it's about waste, I think. And so, yeah, he's alone in the house and he finally thinks he might have glimpsed the thing that's destroyed hundreds all. And of course, what it is his own reflection. Yes. But you see, again, there's room for interpretation there, because some people have said to me, oh, so he leaves the car, he goes to the house, he's got the key, you know, I gave him the key.
Yeah,
he can get into the house, physically get into the house if he wants to.
The keys, he mentions more than once.
He mentions the keys.
Yeah.
The key becomes one of those little objects, that little group of objects he collects. But that scene in the car when he has the dream, for me, was just a sort of an extreme version of other moments in the novel when he has, you know, something. He wakes up and he's had a bad night, you know, and something awful's happened at Hundreds Hall. Or he's at the party and... Do you remember there's that bit where Peter Baker Hyde, I think, says something about him just being, thinking he was there as a doctor.
Yes.
And then he says something about Caroline being plain. And so what I wanted to do there, I suppose, was to suggest that there were, you know, quite a few people there who might have these resentments inside them that then find their awful enactment in the biting of the poor little girl. But he was definitely one of them. And there are, you know, I really tried to make it so that at all the moments in the book where something bad happens, he's in some state of conflict or turmoil.
I mean, I want to ask you a bit about the narrator. And, I mean, that's the most absorbing, extraordinary thing about the book in a way. But just before that, about the supernatural, because you were saying that some people... careful readers of the book still sort of find a way of explaining it without the supernatural. And I guess you called this, when you wrote about it in The Guardian, you called it a sort of gothic novel, and quite a lot of gothic has that element, doesn't it, of is it supernatural or not? And I just wondered about the thing which is that you must have felt as a kind of quite a tricky necessity when you were writing the novel, of those passages where... something deeply weird and apparently open only to supernatural explanation has happened. And not always, but the real biggies, furniture moving around and doors shutting and locking people in and footsteps and invariably happen when he's not there and get reported to him. And I mean, that does seem sort of calculated to allow that reader to decide and to allow Faraday indeed to decide.
No, absolutely. I think I've always admired, you know, I love a scary book and a scary film that just, you know, pulls out all the stops and does the big special effects and things like that. But I think I like more novels and films that are, you know, just a bit like the, you know, there is something genuinely unsettling. M.R. James is brilliant at this because there is this gap between what you're getting and the person who's experiencing it. Often it's told to somebody who tells it to us, or you see, you know, those figures in M.R. James who come chasing that guy down there. Isn't there a figure who comes chasing him? You know, whistle and I'll come to you.
There's a figure, at the edge of the golf course.
A warning to the curious. Yes. There's this figure that's unleashed and you kind of half glimpse it, and it's full of half glimpses in M.R. James, and I love that. So there clearly is something supernatural going on in a story like that. Or A Turn of the Screw, you know, which again, do we think that there are real ghosts, or is it all about the governess?
Yeah.
I really like that undecidability. So, yes, I wanted to leave enough of that in this novel to satisfy my own pleasure in that kind of thing. And I also wanted, you know, I wanted it to be credible, I suppose, that Faraday would remain sceptical. I think the only thing he really sees that's very strange is when he's in the walled garden with Mrs. Ayres and she kind of gasps, and then he sees that she's been cut.
Yeah.
But again, that could be a piece of self-harm, which is how he interprets it. But no, all the other things. So even though we get them reported to us as if we're there, you know, Mrs. Ayres' experiences in the attic with, as you say, the pattering footsteps, the closing door, which could only be supernatural. Nevertheless, they're still at one remove.
But even that scene with the blood, I think it's a brilliant little line of dialogue, because it just seems a very credible line of sort of 1940s posh dialogue, where she says to him, "Oh, doctor, what an innocent you are." And at that moment, I don't know, in a way, you think, God, they are all barking. They're all barking, and they're all obsessed with these kind of mad family things, and she's obsessed with the dead daughter that... You know, she's obsessed with, how do you know? She hasn't mentioned her till page 237 or whatever it is, so she must be. And so even there, I mean, I think you get a very strong sense that perhaps these are sort of just deeply disturbed people.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, we only see them through him. We encounter them through him. We get to know them through his visits, you know. And he is this rather... nerdy, nervy kind of narrator who's sort of, you know, are they this closed group against him? I liked that. Yeah.
So, I mean, this narrator, he's a fantastic narrator. I mean, there are... This is not a kind of boast, because actually I think it was quite late in the day that I began to realise how deeply weird the narrator was, or feel how deeply weird the narrator was. And... I know people who got it much more quickly, but I'd also know people who've read the novel, and I've said to them, the narrator's really sort of, I mean, he's a really strange guy. Really? No, he's a kind of rather boring bloke. No. Yeah, ghost stories always have a rather boring bloke in. I said, no, I think you know, then I have to go back and read it again. And some of the things about it, I mean, to start with a simple thing, the no Christian name thing, which he himself sort of comments on at some stage in the novel. He says, somebody at the dance says, doesn't know quite what to call him, even though they've been at school together.
Oh, it's the builder, I think, when he visits the council houses.
Haven't they been at school together?
That's right.
But, you know, he's a doctor now, so he can't call him by his Christian name. And I was thinking of, I'm sure a book you'd relish, The End of the Affair by Graham Greene, and the narrator says, you know, I'm not the sort of man people call by his Christian name, but you do get to find out what his Christian name is, Bendrix. But Faraday, you never do. And, you know, he says he and Caroline are having an affair, but she never calls him by...
Well, we never see her call him by his Christian name. Yeah, that it is a very coming back to The End of the Affair. It is a kind of something about 40s upper middle class masculinity, isn't it? You know, but actually they kind of don't have first names. You know, what is that about, really? And for me, when I didn't, it's not something I planned with Faraday at all. I just realised after a while that nobody was calling him by his first name. Obviously, he wasn't. I didn't really know what it was because I hadn't needed to use it. Then, of course, I liked, you know, the echoes of the second Mrs. De Winter from Rebecca, which is invoked really where the novel start and going down to the dilapidated house. So that seemed fitting. But yes, I realised it was because he's overly attached to his professional role in that way that people are when they haven't kind of been born to it. You know, he's had to kind of work hard to get it, so he can't quite shake it off. He doesn't really have much of an emotional life. He doesn't have much of a personal life. There was actually only one point in the novel, and it was quite late on when after Caroline has dumped him and he's talking to his friends, David and Anne, and there was a point when Anne, I felt she wanted to use his first name and I just couldn't let her.
Yes.
Obviously. but apart from that, it was completely natural.
Yeah.
And it's been interesting with the book being translated because in some languages, it's come up first in the Netherlands, where there would be a formal and an informal you. A very loaded word, of course, I suppose, in this word. And they've said to me, you know, does he really not have a first name? It's unnatural that Caroline would still be, would you know, what point of, first of all, you know, would Caroline and Roderick shift to using the informal you? And then surely she would be using his name. And they said to me, can you give us a name for him? You know? I was like, well, no, it's part of the book, really, that he doesn't have a name.
You're right, it's that funny masculine. I remember when I got my first job, an older academic colleague who was near retirement, so I was rather lamenting the fact that when he had first started, and when I think all academics were probably that he knew were male, there were progressions. And when you were quite pally with somebody at work, but they weren't really an intimate, you called him by his surname. And that was quite a friendly thing to do, to call a chap.
Well, it kind of smacks of public school and that sort of camaraderie, doesn't it, really? But the other thing, people often notice that, but what people tend not to notice is the fact that Betty doesn't have a surname.
Yes.
Which is a sort of interesting corollary, in a way, you know, that she's kind of denied status, I guess, you know, which always interested me. I mean, it's in a sense one of my starting points for the novel, although it never really got to pursue it in the end. But yeah, they were always kind of counterparts. I mean, she and he are the two who emerge from it all, you know, intact. She more than him, I think, and she's the one who's going off into a kind of, you know, a new Britain. Really.
And she's sort of funny. I mean, in the novel, because I think the reader, certainly first time, has a really sort of odd choice, I think, to make with her, because she's either the most unreliable or the most reliable. And it seems quite an... To the reader, I think it seems quite an either-or choice. And, you know, there's that guy Seeley with his fantastic theories who believes in poltergeists, apparently, when he's had a few whiskies, but says, and then it's women... And you've got you've got one who's going through the menopause, you've got one sexually frustrated one, and you've got a teenage... Well, I mean, take your pick, doesn't it? But sort of Betty is saying from the first, isn't she? Oh, there's something bad here. And yet she ends up, in a way, being the witness that I think the reader most sort of falls back on.
Yeah, absolutely. She's the one who kind of speaks the truth, really, at the inquest. And she has been... seeing things quite clearly for some time, I think. But I did, you know, I wanted them all to be... I wanted us not to know how reliable any of these people were. I mean, one thing... I mentioned this in the little thing I wrote for The Guardian last week, but, you know, I really did have a sense at the start... I was thinking of the Country House murder story and how everybody in those stories is a possible murderer. You know, everybody has a motive. And the act of the novel is to kind of clear those up and, tidy things up until you've got one person left who really has the motive and the means and whatever. So I liked that idea early on with this novel, that all of the characters have their frustrations. Because, you know, I was interested in poltergeists, and what I love about the whole idea of poltergeists is that they're this enactment of unconscious rage, really, unconscious frustrations and aggressions. And often, I think, you know, it's very clear why women and girls are often at the centre of poltergeist stories, because they are about domestic and familial rage and, you know, things getting broken around the house. And I love all that. So, yes, what was I saying about
Betty? About Betty. Betty was where we started.
Yeah, so, yes, I mean, I wanted them all to in a sense, you know, be possible poltergeist centres. Betty's the classic one because she's the teenage girl. Yeah. You know, think of Carrie or something like that, yeah. Don't you? But even, you know, Roderick is... Again, we often think about women and nervous disorders, but of course here you've got Roderick, a man who's been through the war, and like lots of wounded servicemen or unwounded servicemen, you know, having a kind of stress disorder, yeah, as a result. I liked that.
And I mean, I wanted to ask a bit about about sort of time in the novel, actually, which sort of, because, you know, at the risk of being sycophantic, I mean, it is a novel that second, third time round, you start seeing all these clever things you didn't see first time round. That's part of its pleasure. And one of the things I tried to, the first column I wrote on the novel, I tried to write about the pace of it. And actually, it's quite a difficult thing to do, because literary critics never are hopeless about writing and that sort of thing. And I realised after it had been published, as you always do, oh, God, the one thing I missed out, which is the key to it, is the thing I never noticed the first couple of times through the novel, which is not just the time in the sense of the period setting, but the sort of chronology, mm-hmm, of the novel, which... You know, made me think, oh, she's like, you know, Jane Austen used to do that. I mean, she actually consulted calendars quite carefully to sort of get the sort of under the surface. And I noticed only several, you know, on rereading that it's sort of within a year, yeah, isn't it?
And it is, 12 months anyway. Yeah. And actually, I think it sort of worked itself out, because I had to have a length of time that was long enough for the deterioration of this family to seem... slow and fast at the same time, yeah, if you know what I mean. I'm incredibly kind of inching along, but then having these dramatic kind of declines that sort of, you know, this sort of accelerating pace, I suppose, of this family and house just completely heading towards catastrophe. So it had to be not too long, not too short. 12 months seemed like, you know, quite a nice sort of round figure. And also, as my end point, I think I had the NHS coming in June 1948, because, you know, Faraday's dreading that. That seemed to me to be a symbol of a sort of changing Britain. And so it kind of just sorted itself out, really. It just, yeah.
And before we lose Faraday, the thing that, I know you said it jokingly, that it's a novel shocking for the absence of lesbianism in it. But you've got a male narrator. But more than that, you have one of the most sort of wonderfully, painfully awkward, literally physically awkward. I mean, Faraday calls it a courtship. God, I wouldn't call it that. He calls it an affair two or three times, you know, and... Mm. I mean, you know, the end of the affair, that's an affair, isn't it? But I mean, and these kind of descriptions of sort of a stockinged toe here and a sort of attempt at a kiss there. I mean, it's a very... was that a sort of important ingredient right at the beginning, or did that come with the sense of his sort of unreliability?
That actually came pretty late, that whole thing with him and Caroline. I hadn't planned it at all. I planned there to be no romantic element. He was literally just going to befriend the family. And in fact, until, you know, quite late on with the drafts, in a funny sort of way, Mrs. Ayres was more at the centre of the story than Caroline was. So the thing that happens to Mrs. Ayres, the incident in the attic and her subsequent kind of, you know, losing her to this whatever it is, delusions and possible self-harm or whatever it is, culminating in her hanging herself and being discovered to be horribly sort of bruised and whatnot, that all happened to Caroline. And it was Mrs. Ayres was going to be the final one of them to get sort of bumped off. And Faraday's interest was sort of divided between the two women for a while for me, in the sense that he was sort of almost erotically enthralled to the whole family, the whole, yeah, house, in that sort of bride's-heady kind of way, you know. But I found that I liked Caroline a lot. She was always much more alive for me than Mrs. Ayres, who, frankly, I sometimes struggled to really get inside. Whereas with Caroline, I liked her and I thought she was funny. And she and Faraday developed this quite bantering relationship. And then I took them to that dance.
Oh, that dance is great. We all love the dance.
The hospital dance. And do you know where that came from, really? There's a book by Christiana Brand called Green for Danger, which is set in a hospital. It's a 40s crime novel. And there might be a dance in the book, but there's a film version of it with Alistair Sim as a detective. And there's a great dance scene, a hospital dance. God, it sounds really drearily 40s, doesn't it? And they do this Paul Jones, this dance where you gallop around, you know, and whichever partner you get, and you can tell everybody's sort of slightly, you know, trying to get the right one. And so that's kind of where that came from. I was really taken with it. And then, yes, they have this sort of awful encounter in a car afterwards. But it just... The funny thing is, though, you know, it was that, almost that accidental, that happening. But then I realised it was just right. You know, it was just right. It was all about him homing in on, finding a way into Hundreds, and her really wanting a way out. You know, it was doomed from the start. But then once I'd seen it there, I could go back and plant, you know, make them notice each other more and things like that.
I mean, for me, that was sort of when on my first reading, when his perception of things really did, when I started thinking this narrator's really out of kilter, because, you know, whenever she says, "Oh, I'm not that interested," you're mad, you know. You're,
yeah. Isn't that just heterosexuality, though? I thought that was just...
Well, maybe there's some of that, but also that you know, he, by his own account of the evidence, her responsiveness is so near zero. You know, and he's quite painstaking, isn't it? You make him. Painstaking seems to be the right word, because there's pain involved in reading it. Of by his own account, you know, he's getting almost nowhere.
Yes, that's true. And it was an interesting thing with Caroline to try and make her sexy. You know, despite I wanted her to be a sexy woman, a sexual woman, I suppose I mean, in a body that other people were finding rather plain. And yet, like Seeley, you know, he says, "Oh, there's something there," in that horrible way. But he's right. You know, there is something there. I think she's got this great capacity, this great erotic potential. But it's just, you know, Faraday isn't going to press the right buttons.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. and I mean, Faraday, we used the word unreliable, and you used that word when you wrote about the book on last Saturday in the Guardian. But as you're also saying something there, which is, I think, quite hard to achieve, which is a kind of weird balance between the fact that he is our conduit for the sort of strangeness of what's going on. But actually, you know, he's always saying things like, I'm not a man given to duplicity. Mm. And he's sort of that, he thinks he's speaking the truth there, doesn't he?
Yes, yes.
So there's a sort of, he's sort of reliable, as well as, he's not exactly unreliable. He's more sort of, what's the right word? I don't know, sort of deluded almost.
Yeah. Yes, because again, it comes back to this thing. For me, there were always these two layers to the book. There was the layer that he was genuinely perceiving, and then there was this other stuff going on underneath that sort of, for him, or erupts into his narrative through things like dreams and, you know, his black, he doesn't talk about black moods, but he talks about those odd moods he has, you know, those odd fits time to time. And those glimpses, those glimpses he has and sort of hurriedly suppresses. So yeah, the challenge. I mean, this was a very straightforward novel to write and a great pleasure to write. But the real challenge of it, and the thing I did have to work most on, was, you know, trying to keep that surface, but also finding ways that he, despite himself, despite that surface, could tell us, could reveal these things.
Because he does this thing, doesn't he, of saying it was as if. All the time.
Yes, I was very interested in you picking up on that, because I think, actually, to be fair, it's probably me more than Faraday who uses that phrase. I'm sure I use it in other novels. But it does, I think you were right, and I hadn't really thought about this before, that it is this great way for him to sort of stay anchored within the rational, you know, but to open up these little windows.
Because actually, if you look back over, as I pedantically in my way did, over his as-ifs, almost everyone, you could actually say, "How do you? What? Hang on. I mean, that's not. That's just a sort of. I think almost the first one he says about, which is about Roderick. Roderick says something like, "Oh, so you're the doctor?" Something completely innocent. He reports the words, and then he says something like, "But he said in a rather slow drawl, as if he were already bored with the sight of me." I mean, that is. That's in him, yes. Isn't it? You know.
But that's what As If does, isn't
yes.
it? It takes you away from the sort of surface of the narrative into something more and more emotional. You know, I mean, that's what As If does for all of us. Aren't we all carrying these sort of parallel stories along with us? You know, this is why I love the Gothic. I think the Gothic allows us to explore and enact the irrational. You know, we live and we function in a rational world, in a rational way, but continually, all the time, we're behaving irrationally, you know, or we're overwhelmed or possibly overwhelmed by irrational feelings. And it's the as if, you know, I'm sitting here, but it's as if I'm under the lights of the Gestapo or something. You know what I mean? It's that kind of... And I really, more and more, I think, as a writer, I'm interested in normality, you know, in the extent that normality, normal people, which most of us are, can contain these extraordinary, quite wild, you know, this range of emotional experience.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the great thing is Faraday's convinced that he's not a wild, you know, but he is absolutely, you know, I'm rather limited sort of thing. Mm. But actually, listen to what he's saying. Mm. And but anyway, it's time for me to give everybody else a chance. We've got microphones, I'm afraid.
Well, I have a comment and a question. First of all, I must say, I was on to the doctor straight away. I was one of those. When he got out his pen knife at 10 and hacked out the plaster, I thought, oh, my God. So for me, the turn of the screw of the book was, when are they going to figure out what he's up to, even though he doesn't know? So that was what made it so painful to read for me. But the question I have, and the real achievement to me of the book was Caroline. I thought she was a terrific creation. And I wanted to know if, even late in the day, because that was very interesting what you said about Mrs. Ayers was to be last, does that mean that you always intended that they would, the family would all have to die? I really wanted Caroline to live. I really wanted her to get away, and it broke my heart when she didn't. Did you always intend that?
I did. I did. And I usually...
Well, Roderick doesn't die, does he? It's just some living death.
A living death.
Yeah.
In that
yeah.
case, why?
Uh-huh. I did, and I'm usually pretty firm with my books. You know, once I've decided, firm with my characters, I suppose I should say, once I've decided their fates, I very rarely change them. And this novel was a novel for me with a bleak ending. I knew it was going to be a bleak ending. I had, quite early on, I had that vision of you know, that the house... you know, untenanted, falling apart, while the world moved on around it, and Faraday still enthralled to the house, I suppose, still in kind of lonely possession of the house. And that I knew that I was working towards that. And I guess I could have had that. I could have sent Caroline off to Canada or something, couldn't I?
It was all set for that. I booked her ticket.
And other readers have complained about that, about Caroline. I'm sorry, but... yeah, I don't know.
You wanted the Pyrrhic victory. You wanted the empty house and him.
Yeah.
Because the only way he could be in the empty house was if she didn't sell it. And the only way she would not sell it is she wasn't.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah, exactly.
You understand
that's how much
the
I
terrible...
believed in her, though. That's how much I believed in her. I thought she was terrific. I really wanted her to win.
Hi. I'd like to ask about how and why you chose the location for the novel. I've got a particular personal point. I grew up in South Birmingham in the 1940s and 50s, so I knew that area a little bit at that time. And somehow I think there's probably some significance to the location. It's very much literally Middle England, and I was wondering, you know, why, how and why you chose it.
Yes, well, I'll tell you how I chose it, because it's sort of completely linked to where this book came from, really. And the initial starting point for this novel... I've written about this in The Guardian, actually, so forgive me if you've seen this already. But I'd been reading a lot of 40s fiction and was interested in class. And one particular novel that had actually always fascinated me since I first read it years ago was The Franchise Affair by Josephine Tay, a crime novel from 1948, which actually retells a true crime story from the 18th century about a maidservant called Elizabeth Canning who disappeared for a month. And when she turned up, she was all bruised and emaciated and claimed she'd been abducted by two women who wanted to force her into prostitution. And it became this huge, controversial case and very dramatic. Anyway, Tay retells that story for a 48 audience. And she turns Elizabeth Canning into Betty Kane, who's this working-class Midlands girl who disappears, turns up bruised, claims she's been abducted by two middle-class women who want her to be their servant, kept her in this lonely house. And again, it becomes this case that the tabloid newspapers take up, and it's a big drama. And the Franchise Affair is set in the Midlands. It's set really more or less where I end up setting The Little Stranger. And initially, I wanted to sort of try and rewrite that novel. It's so fascinating in its attention to class and its snobbery, really. Betty Kane, the teenage girl, is just completely vilified, really, from, you know, to the detriment of the novel. It would be a far more interesting novel if we weren't sure whether she'd been abducted. But the fact is, we're on the side of the middle-class mother and daughter right from the start. And anyway, read it, because it is a fascinating novel. And so, actually, all that remained in my novel from that, really, is Betty, who's a sort of, you know, a sort of vestigial character from my first idea, because then I brought in the Gothic elements and turned it into something quite different. But I kept the Midland setting, partly because, as you say, it has that sort of Middle England tradition. You know, it's got that old England. You know, Caroline mentions Shakespeare at one point and the idea that people are coming to the area because they like the thought that it's the heart of England. And I wanted a rural setting because I thought that those class changes that were happening in the middle of the century, and especially after the Second World War, I felt that they might, you know, their impact was very definite on those rural communities that had been quite feudal, really, for many centuries, and suddenly were really changing. So, but I didn't know Warwickshire at all well when I started the book, so I had to do some homework and make trips there.
I'm going back almost to the first question. I was convinced it was Faraday from page 3, when he destroys the acorn, puts it in his pocket, because he says something like, I'm not a destructive boy or a vindictive boy, but I love this house and I want to possess it. And for me, the affair was between Faraday and the house. And it was only when Caroline said, oh, I'm leaving it, I'm going off, that he had to kill her in order to possess this house. And the fact that he had no Christian name is why she said, you. Because otherwise it'd be no Arthur, David, whatever. And to me, I mean, I was just waiting for the working out of the plot, but I was quite clear in my mind that it was him from the beginning. Mm-hmm. Why an acorn? I know from acorns great things grow, but acorn significant?
I mean, well, not really, except it's small and you'd probably want to catch hold of it, especially if you had
a strawberry.
Small hands. Yeah, I guess the acorn thing, you know, the tall oaks thing. It's funny, you know, when I was a kid, I loved old things. I mean, I grew up in a council house, you know, and it wasn't in it by any means an old house, but I knew I wanted an old house from a very early age. And I used to walk through a cemetery on the way to school. This is when I was about 11, about the same age as Dr. Faraday. I used to walk through with my friend Jane, and there was a chapel of rest, I suppose, in the middle with these Gothic corbels, you know, these faces, and we absolutely loved these faces, and we wanted them. So we planned to go there with screwdrivers and prise them off and take them home. And it seemed completely natural. And it wasn't about vandalism. I wasn't, as Dr. Fraser says, you know, I wasn't a destructive child, a vandal. I wanted what this represented. I wanted, you know, it sort of represented history and culture, I suppose.
That's the emblem of the National Trust, isn't it?
The acorn.
Yeah.
Yes.
I just wondered if that was accidental.
Well, this was a great time for the National Trust, of course. It was sort of birth of the National Trust.
And presumably Faraday was not an accidental surname, was it? He's
Faraday
the voice
was
of reason and science, isn't he?
Faraday was an accidental surname. And it was really came when he was, at the start, for me, he was much more of a middle-class figure. Faraday sounded a bit posh. It sounded right, I don't know. And then, but by the time I decided to make him more of a working class boy made good, and the name perhaps didn't feel quite right then, it was too late. He had become Faraday for me. And it was only then when he starts treating Roderick and he gets, you know, he has that electrical machine.
Yeah.
I got very taken with that electrical machine. And that process is called Faradism, I discovered.
Really?
Like, my God, I could never call it by its name because it was too weird that he wouldn't comment on it, you know. And other people have said to me, oh, is it about the Faraday cage?
Yeah.
Actually, I don't really know what a Faraday cage is, but it's a nice idea, you know, that the name has a sort of resonance. No, it was completely
happy coincidence.
Sarah does, I don't know, Sarah does something characteristically clever about the acorn as well, in that I was thinking, oh, it's a sign of his secret wishes, but then you make him tell the Ayers is about this, doesn't he? And then they go, as posh people would, oh, yes, we all felt like doing that as well, you know, in that sort of don't worry about it.
Yes.
And that gives... I sort of felt on, you know, second time round, that was a rather so brilliant kind of... It was as if it had... that particular resentment had been purged because he'd told them about it.
Yes, maybe. Of course, he's also appalled to discover that the frieze is now all plaster, battered and chipped anyway, you
he
know.
He expected marble and he got plaster.
Yes, yes, but also, you know, when he revisits it as an adult, it's all manky and chipped because the house is falling down. And, of course, for him... picking it off was a sort of act of homage, you know, not homage, homage. You know? But then the other people doing that is neglect. You know, it's this weird. It's about harm again, isn't it? Harm and self-harm.
Of course, his mother throws it on the fire.
Throws it on the fire. Yeah, I would have liked to have been able to have him keep it really and put it with those little objects. But I thought, oh, that's too much. That's just too silly.
I was just wondering what research you did for the house, because it had such a strong feeling for me, that, you know, the sense of place, and I just wondered what research you did on those types of houses, really.
Well, I looked at lots of images of country houses, including lost country houses. There are some wonderful books with great photos of those, you know, extraordinary to think of them, having once been there on the landscape and then they're not there anymore. And I also visited a lot of houses. I visited a lot National Trust own. And also there are lots of country houses still in private hands that sort of open 2 days a year, you know, and I think for tax reasons, I suppose. And you turn up and you get taken around by a rather Caroline-type figure in a sort of shapeless tweed skirt. And... that was very interesting. That was great. And I was always desperate to kind of see into the, you know, the sort of servants' bits. And so I tried to get a sense of what it would be really like to live in a house like that. There's a hotel near Hay on Wye called Mockus Court, which physically is rather like Hundreds Hall. And I got to stay there. My partner and I got to stay there. We turned up and they had a black Labrador. This black Labrador came bounding. It was quite spooky. And because we were the only guests, you know, we could... sitting in the drawing room at night, we didn't tell him this, but we sort of experimented turning the lights off and things like that to see. Because what I'd written a scene where Dr. Faraday goes to the little parlour and they're sitting on the sofa by the fire with all the lights behind them turned off, and he sees it as quite cosy. But when I did it, in this big room, actually it was quite menacing, you know, with this sort of, okay, you're okay here in the light, but there's this huge great room behind you that's dark. It was interesting, things like that. Yeah, so I really tried to write about the book in a way that's in a very physical kind of material way.
I was when I was rereading it, I was struck by the very creepy passage where the S's that have been scrawled onto the walls are spotted. But on the second time of reading it, the creepiness was the fact that the way Faraday narrates it, because he's moved on from as ifing, and he describes... the actions of the other characters, like, oh, Mrs. Ayers moved her hands in a certain way, what Caroline was wearing, which were things that I was certain that Caroline would not have told him. And I'm sort of rereading it again. I feel like he's just making stuff up, which just makes him even more sort of freakish and strange. And I just wondered if that was a sort of intentional passage before he starts projecting himself, almost sort of going along the lanes to Hundreds Hall. And after the as-ifing, he does have this trick of... Well, it's to do with him being unreliable or reliable, this illusion of reliability, because he describes things in such detail that he hasn't seen.
Yes.
So, yes, I just wondered if... Because I thought that was really creepy.
Yes, good. Yes, I think I found that quite creepy as well, this idea that he sort of colonised the house, you know. He often talks about things like mould on the walls and damp, spreading damp, and actually he's a bit of a fungus in a way, isn't he? And... I do like him as well, you know. I feel like I have to stick up for Dr. Faraday too. I do think he is a genuinely nice bloke, actually. And I also feel that there are quite a lot of similarities between me and him, including I had this really weird moment when after I'd finished the book, I think, and I remembered that I'd done a PhD and that I am, in fact, a doctor. And that might not sound like very much, but it was quite a chilling moment when I realised there was this level of identification with Dr. Faraday that I hadn't glimpsed myself. It was all there under the surface. So, But yes, I was aware that that was a shift. You know, he's suddenly telling us stuff, as you say, in great detail, he hasn't personally witnessed. And how would that be for a reader? I wasn't sure how it would be for a reader, really. But I liked the idea, because, of course, especially because of the nature of the stuff he's narrating, you know, I was hoping that the effect of it, of the prose, would be to carry you along, and you wouldn't even really think about that. Oh, but then yeah. when you stopped and thought about it like you have done, you would think, hang on a minute, is he, you know, how much of this is reliable?
I think that's the first time you read it, you're just sort of carried away with it, and these, because I remember reading that passage really late at night and being very scared. But the second time I read it, I was like, oh, this is very strange. And I suppose, I mean, it feeds into the end as well with Betty. I mean, thinking again about that, the fact that the only reason we know that that Caroline said you is from Betty's testimony at the inquest, and yes. how reliable is that as well?
It's been a couple of months now since I read the book, so I can't remember all the detail, but one of the secondary characters that I haven't forgotten is Anne, and Anne and her husband seem to me to be the only genuine friends that Faraday's got. And I think it's quite interesting that Anne confirms, or is the only one to confirm, something that the reader has known for ages, that Caroline doesn't care for Faraday at all and was kind of unconsciously using him to try and get away from the house. And of course, he wanted to get into it. Did you mean for Anne to become quite significant, or is she even significant in your mind? But she really stood out for me because she's the only one that seems to know what the reader knows.
Oh, I'm glad you like Anne. I think I'm sure one of my reviewers said that she and David were awfully cardboard or something. And but for me, they occupied that role of being Dr. Faraday's friends. They are his only real friends, and I think they are genuine friends of his. This comes back to him being on the surface quite a nice bloke, and probably the kind of bloke that married women would slightly worry about and want to fix up with somebody and that kind of thing. I tried to make them... They're serving a role in the book. They really are. So there was a limit to what I could do with them, I guess. But I tried to make them sympathetic and vaguely interesting in their own right, you know.
But Anne gets a sort of... she does get the kind of... The discerning, I mean, because she's a woman, I suppose, when Faraday first starts talking, I think, to them about the troubles he's having with Caroline,
yes.
or her signs of reluctance, David says, oh, you know, it'll be fine, you know, women always like this, oh, Anne turned me down all sorts of numbers of times. But and then Faraday says something like, but Anne didn't look quite so sure. Isn't that right? I mean, I missed it. It's more elegantly done than that, but something like that,
yeah,
isn't it?
No, absolutely. And in a way, it's sort of playing with, again, especially perhaps with 40s gender, you know, and the women being rather sensitive and very attuned to those domestic subtleties. And the men, not at all. I mean, Angela Thurkell has great fun with that in her books. But yes, she's definitely not convinced, is she, at that point? Yeah.
There's a lady at the back and then another one right at the back.
Thank you. I just wanted to ask you, in my local book group, we were all quite taken with, although you said there were no lesbians in the group, there's a lot of suggestive sexual text, particularly in the scene between Faraday and Roderick when he's doing that medical stuff on him. And I wondered how you responded to the charge that there is some homoeroticism there, if not something further.
A charge? You've been charged. Charged with covert homoeroticism. Overt's fine. Covert's very tricky.
Yes, it's funny. I mean, for a book that I had planned to have no sort of erotic element at all, and certainly no homoerotic element, I think it did end up being quite a queer sort of novel. You know, I mean, Caroline is quite butch, and lots of people have read her as a possible lesbian or a repressed lesbian or something, which I have to say I didn't intend. I sort of wanted her to be a kind of awkward heterosexual, you know, or at least awkward with Faraday. You know, she'd be fine with somebody else. But she's not, clearly not at ease in the sort of that sort of feminine, middle-class feminine role of the time. But yes, you're right, I think. I think, again, it comes back to what I was saying before about Faraday being slightly in love with all of them, really, in that bride's heady kind of way. You know, they've all got this sort of luster for him, and Roderick Yes, there is that odd scene with his leg. And yeah, I just wanted there to be this kind of free-floating desire, I guess, desire going around. Ultimately, I think Faraday is a hugely desiring character. And that, in a sense, is, you know, again, to come back to Poltergeists, it's all about like a kind of infantile. I mean, the things that Poltergeists have been charged with doing over the centuries are incredibly infantile. And I think it is about that sort of infantile rage and also about consumption. I always thought, for me, what Faraday does with Hundreds Hall is to consume it, you know, both in the sense that he possesses it, but he destroys it at the same time. For me, he was this great big kind of consuming figure. So, yes, I guess that does play out. So guilty as charged.
To me, the main protagonist of the novel was definitely the house. I mean, I fell in love with the house right from the start. And your descriptions were, in some places, absolutely, I think I used the word beguiling once. It became alive. And I felt that somehow, I'm not English, so I have no idea about, you know, the upper middle classes in their houses. But I have met people from in other countries who worked in great houses. And they have many have a love affair with the house. And this is brought out when they talk to their children, when they talk to other people about it. That's the house has a soul. I felt very much that this young man, or Faraday as a young boy, his mother was his first lover, of course, and he was in competition with her, with this house that took her over, and he was only allowed to see small bits of it. And I felt that he, right from the start, I thought, this is what he wants. He wants this house. He doesn't really care about the people. Am I right? Or near right?
No, I think absolutely. I mean, the house did become a big presence in the book, just as other buildings. I think in other of my novels, Millbank Prison, for example, my second novel, Affinity, is set in a women's prison in the 19th century. And I did a lot of research into Millbank.
Gothic always has a building.
Exactly. And I think you can often link it. You know, they are often these dark, secret, slightly damp places, you know. And I know lots of critics have linked them back to the maternal body. So I think you're probably really onto something there with Faraday and his mother and that infantile rage and you know, desire. I think probably is something about infants and mothers that's probably at the heart of the book somewhere. But yes, houses. I love houses. I love old houses, and it was a great pleasure really to try and bring one to life. You know, but ultimately too, it's a psychological structure. That's what I like about the structures in Gothic fiction, that they are ultimately a bit crazy. You know, you think they're ordinary, but they've got these things are at strange angles, or there are secret passages or odd passages and attics. It's always those nooks and crannies, rather like the mind, really. So, for example, the staircase at the heart of the house, I'm not even sure if that's architecturally possible, but it became very important. You know, I like the idea of it being right at the core of the house, and of course, it plays a crucial role in Caroline's fate. So, yeah, I was very taken myself with details. When I visited houses, I just observed different things. And really, I guess Hundreds Hall is a bit of a patchwork. Do you know Up Park in Sussex? There's a big country house that actually was reconstructed because it burnt down. But that has a little parlour, for example. I was very taken with the name, the little parlour. And it's got this fantastic junction of bells and wires in the basement that sort of sent things doing this when people rang for the servants. And that was in my mind when I talk about the junction box in the basement in The Little Stranger. So, yes, it's houses. I think they're always going to be there in my novels. And, of course, when you're writing about this family and its fate, a class of people, those houses were such a symbol of the decline of a particular class. There's always something poignant about houses. They're built for a particular cultural moment, a particular social and cultural moment, and almost immediately the world starts changing and they remain there. You know, they remain frozen, this sort of frozen image of a particular social dynamic or a family dynamic. So there's something haunted, I think, about all houses in that sense. The older they get, the more poignant they are.
I want to ask, actually, about the haunted aspect of the book in the form of Susan. And that she... And the psychological aspects is that you've just mentioned... Were the 1940s a period that were attractive to you because, in a way, you had to resist going into too much of the psychoanalysis and what would be deemed today psychobabble about the loss of a child and the aspect and the impact that had on her two children who didn't even know about the child for a long time. And I just thought that was part of me wanted, because nowadays it's so easily talked of, and I thought you can't in that period. And was that deliberate?
Well, I was certainly very, I guess I was conscious of that as an issue when I was writing about the 40s. I mean, actually, I think people had started talking about the supernatural in psychoanalytic terms from about the 20s onwards. Certainly now I'm looking at the 20s and I'm reading ghost stories, not for my new book, just because I'm interested in them. I've been reading Mae Sinclair wrote some ghost stories from that period, and she's very, very self-consciously sort of making psychoanalytic interpretations of the ghosts as she's writing them. And certainly I think it's hard now to resist interpreting ghosts and hauntings and poltergeists, as I've been doing, in psychoanalytic terms. You know, they're all about guilt, repressed guilt, the return of the repressed and family dynamics and things that are unresolved, you know, unresolved conflicts being endlessly played out. The conversion, you know, hysterical conversion symptoms. This was the house for me was like a hysterical person. It was kind of developing symptoms. But what was great, I suppose, about the 40s setting is that some people, that kind of way of talking about the supernatural was available, but not to everybody. So, I mean, Seeley, sort of, that's what he's talking about. But Faraday, it's not something that Faraday is comfortable with, although he talks about it a bit. So it was, I could use it and not use it as I wanted to, really.
When we started, asked Sarah how long she wanted to go on, and she said as long as anybody wants to ask questions. So you can blame me for being the one to stop it. But Sarah signed books if you yes anybody like to out at the front afterwards. So I'll take her round the back. She'll disappear, but she will reappear. And I'm sure we'd all just want to thank her very much for coming and talking so closely.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.